This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of My Argyle Life, the series in which we delve into the stories of those on the terraces, in the offices, and occasionally on the pitch. We convene just days after fellow Devon side Torquay United are placed into administration, and I'm sure we'll touch on their fight later on in the pod, but it is nevertheless a timely reminder of those dark days that we faced as a club. In the last episode, it could be the last episode, depending on the order, we spoke to Graham Clark, former chairman of the Fans Trust, and now a regular on this very podcast. So it's now only right that we catch up with his successor, Mr. Chris Webb. How's things?
Very good, lads. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. You've had a long day, but not as long as me, as we were discussing off air. Basically, we always start these pods off with like the age-old terrace chant. Who are you?
So, yeah, my name's Chris. I've been an Argyle fan my whole life. Introduced to the club by my dad, like probably quite a lot of us. Sort of taken to the home park at the age of 4 years old, trying to force it on me. I think I was maybe a bit too young to understand it then, but fell in love with the club. You know, probably like a lot of fans, Argyle over the years, when they're not doing too well, when we were relegated into what's now League One. And then the glory era, probably my favourite time still now, really, following Argyle, was Peter Shiltman's team, as he put together the Nerley Men. And just remember being in school and with all my mates and being, you know, that step where you could stop going with your dad and start going with your mates. And just being so in love with that team, that brand of football. And like, yeah, never looking back since. Promotions, relegations, nearly losing the club, rebuilding the club, and back doing really well now.
Yeah, on that journey, I'm sure we'll get into it in a bit more detail, hopefully, if Sam remembers his history right. We'll get into that. But obviously, your early days, you've already mentioned, you know, Peter Shilton and the Nearly Men. Who from those teams growing up do you remember fondly?
The whole of that team really was class. You know, Steve Castle, Steve McCall, Nugent. I mean, it's just beautiful footballing team. But my personal favourite was, you know, God rest his soul, Alan Nichols, the goalkeeper. I just loved it. Like, you know, being on the terraces, you know, as a young lad and seeing somebody on the pitch you could imagine like seeing yourself in. You know, well, I used to love it. It don't matter if we were just 1-0 up and the opposition team was all over us and we'd sing like Nichols, what's the score? And he'd have the confidence to just put the score up and give us a 1-0 or whatever. Mm. And I remember also my first ever game at Exeter away, watching Argyle. And my dad got me tickets. He said to him, you're going to go to Exeter away, your first ever game. We're still quite young. And I was super excited. And he took me all the way to the ground before he told me that the tickets were actually in the big bank in the Exeter end. So I went there with my dad and I got two like really strong abiding memories from that. Well, three actually. We won, which was great. Shilton's team turned him over on a 4-2 on a hell of a night. So that was one of the three memories. The second memory was my dad, who was a heavy smoker, the Exeter had this giant flag that came over, and my dad and quite a few other Argyle fans were stubbing their cigarettes out in the flag. That was my second memory. But my third memory, perhaps the most, or second most after the win, enjoyable, was Nichols coming out to the Big Bank, getting absolute, like, shed load of abuse and returning it with a V signal and giving them the bird. So, yeah, he was like a proper terrorist cult hero.
Obviously, beyond Peter Shilton's years and beyond past your first away day, you've done several since then as well. When did your, like, I don't want to step on Sam's toes here where he takes over your actual involvement, but when did, like, you start getting involved more and more with Argyle before the trust, before you joined there? Was there, like, any point where you started to realise that your involvement was increasing beyond the point of this becoming more than a passion and more of it, like, becoming your life?
Yeah, I mean, sort of like most, I mean, my sort of Argyle life, like, as a fan, really, is pretty standard in, like, I would want to go on a Saturday afternoon, get to the pub, rock up to the ground at 2:55, you know, give some abuse to the referee and the linesman, cheer the team, go home, moan about it for the next week, and then recycle it, sort of thing. And I was adamant, because, I mean, I still work now for a trade union, and I worked then for a trade union representing people every day of the week. And what I went to football for a rest from that, went to Argyle for a change of scenery, if you like, you know. So I had zero ambition in getting involved with Argyle, you know, sort of in my spare time. And I suppose I watched the club go into crisis, the period where the players weren't being paid and the staff weren't being paid for months, the administrator coming in, Peter Risdale coming in, the formation of the trust and people doing an incredible job with that. And the situation just seemed to get worse and worse and worse. And I particularly remember, like, there was a big public meeting, I think it was at the Guildhall, and I thought, probably made a mistake there, but I thought, I'm going to go along. That was the first time I'd ever, like, crossed over, if you like, my working life into, like, an Argyle being anything other than the football. And, you know, the administrator was there, Peter Risdale was there, and the trust were doing a great job there. They were there then. But I just was sitting in the audience thinking, like, this is a bit soft. I think these guys are getting away with a lot here. And I think, you know, they're basically preying on people's decency. And I thought we could push a little bit more. So I, sort of semi-separate from that, there was an advert from the trust steering group then, who was, like, basically seeking people to help do different things. Like, you know, if you can do some comms, if you can get involved in the committee, if you can raise some funds and stuff. And I dropped a note to the then secretary and a really good friend of mine now, Peter Ryan of the Fans Trust, and said, you know, I work for a trade union, but I do communications a lot. You know, if you want someone to, you know, prep some social media out or give you a hand, then, you know, let's do it. And I'm up for it. And then Peter rang me maybe a few days afterwards and said, yeah, we'd really love you to come on board. Argyle were playing, I think, my memory's a bit fazy, but I think it was, might have been Brentford away that Saturday. And he said, we've got a steering committee on the Saturday before Brentford. I think it was in a Premier Inn or something by the ground. Do you want to come along? And I thought, yeah, I'll come along. So I went along. The committee was great. It was, everyone was really sound. And, you know, I thought, oh, you know, I can help out a little bit here. That'll be great. The following week to that was my union's conference down in Bournemouth. So I went to the conference to do my obviously day job, and Graham, who you had on the previous episode, Graham Clark, rang me and said, there's a couple of bits of information. And I said, what's that? And he said, like, I've decided to step down. Now is the right time to me to step down as chair of the trust. And I was, oh, you know, really sad. I don't, you know, think that's a sort of negative for the fans, etc., you know, right? And I said, what's the other thing? He said, we've met and we think it should be you that takes over the trust. So, like, from a week of, like zero involvement, all of a sudden, like, a week later, so later, I'm the chair of the trust. And it's like, and I said, all right, okay. So there's one more thing. He said, and this is like 9 o'clock at night, 7 o'clock to morning, that they want you on BBC Radio Devon to introduce yourself as the new chair. So in that sort of spat of, like, a week of, like, not being bothered, not being involved at all, I was all of a sudden the chair of the fans trust.
Yeah, I mean, there's some similarities there with how Graham took over himself, yeah, by the sounds of it. It's similar to how Sam accosted me in the pub and made me involved in Argyle Life. A week later, I had the Twitter login. So, you know, not to compare it really, you know. But obviously, much like yourself with Graham, I think this is where Sam takes over from me and runs us through those, you know, fateful days of administration.
Yes, indeed. Hello again, Chris. Long time no see. I've known Chris a very long time, pretty much since those days he's been mentioning, really, and they were days I still remember pretty well. A lot has happened since then, and certainly both on the pitch and in all of our lives. But I do remember those days very well still. For a little bit of context, for those who haven't heard the Graham interview, I was briefly involved in the sort of, not even the steering committee, more like the pre-steering committee. And I basically had to step down when it became official steering committee because I was 17 and I wasn't yet 18. So I didn't quite cross over with Chris on the trust board, but we were heavily involved in doing stuff for the Green Taverners, weren't we, Chris, who became very much aligned with the trust at that time. We had a few boozy nights in the cherry tree, didn't we, back in those days? And so it's going to be interesting interviewing you about stuff that I myself remember, so I'll try not to waffle any more than I have this last minute or so. So Chris, yeah, you took over then. What was that first week or two like as you sort of began to cope with the media attention? All the same time, it's all hitting the fan off the pitch, isn't it, with the administration becoming closer and closer that week, that really the points deduction came in. Talk me through as best you can those first two or three weeks of being the trust chair whilst everything was falling apart around you.
So yeah, thanks Sam, and yeah, I remember those moments of you and those beers and shots, many of them very fondly at the Cherry Tree and other establishments as well. It was mad, it was wild, you know, and when you're in something, like anything in life, it seems to have a sense of normality. But then when you think back, you think, what was that all about, you know? But I sort of just really just thought, right, okay, you know, what's been going well? What's not? What can I apply to this? And like, let's methodically go for it. And you mentioned a couple of things there, which had triggered a couple of thoughts. So the first was, you know, obviously you had the trust, which had a sort of a growing membership, and had a growing respect amongst the fan base. You also had the Green Taverners, which had the same. And then you had the internet, Pasotti, Plymouth Argyle fans on the internet. And what was seeming to me is one of my sort of things I spotted earlier on was there was a little bit of three separate organisations, like almost covering some of the same ground, and like a little bit of small P politics creeping in, like in terms of territory. So my first thing really was spotting that was to bring people together and say, like, you know, we're not going to have that. We're not going to have, like, everything's not going to be the glory of the trust or of Pasotti or of the Taverners. It's going to be about saving the club. So we need to raise money for the staff. We need to raise the profile for the fans. We need to raise engagement for the fans. So all three of us as organisations can work together. And that went sort of really, really well. The other thing I did, which I thought was a really good launch pad, and I'll tell you some good like anecdotes now, was the meeting that sort of inspired me to write to Peter Ryan that I detailed earlier on in the Guild Hall, was where I was sat there thinking, like, you know, I would have run this as a union meeting versus like what this is. So one of the first things he did in the first couple of weeks was once we'd got everyone together, we got everyone going, I started sort of posting online. I think we tried to introduce a little bit more of a militant tone with a fan base. We recalled that meeting, and it was on a Tuesday night in the lower Guild Hall. And it was as rammed as a rammed meeting could get in the Guild Hall. It was absolutely packed out. And I invited, Brendan Guilfoyle, the administrator, Peter Risdale was the acting chairman, and Vivian Pengelly, rest her soul, who was the leader of the city council at that time, to address the meeting. And I remember speaking to a load of my mates, this is something I don't think I've ever told anyone, before the thing, and saying, like, when Guilfoyle and Risdale come in, give them an hard time. Like, nothing physical, nothing stupid, but make them feel as if they're not welcome anymore. They're not here to run the show. The fans are here to run the show. And I can remember I had the microphone and, you know, Guilfoyle and Risdale were coming in, and there was like a little bit of a kerfuffle, put it in a politely word, at the entrance there. And I can remember taking the mic and say, let them through, everyone, let them through. And I can remember Brendan Guilfoyle coming to the front and saying, thank you for looking after us there, Chris, even though I'd sort of set the interaction up. And I thought then that was a nice moment because I was sort of starting to say, like, you guys aren't in control anymore. And sort of, you know, used the meeting to fire everyone up effectively and sort of set a different tone that, like, you know, the fans were now in control of this situation, not administrators, not politicians, not club officials. The fans were here to take control. So I think that was positive. And then I think we started the process, Sam, of setting about who's going to buy this club, because, like, you know, we need someone to buy it. So that was the first couple of weeks, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting there. There's a lot you said there I'd like to pick up on. But just to focus, first of all, on Brendan Guilfoyle. Again, I think listeners who'll heard Graham's will know very well who he is. But, you know, for those who've not, I'll briefly explain. I'm sure you could provide a different perspective. He was the man who was the representative on behalf of the P&A administration company who the club effectively hired to administrate the club and find an owner. And often when I retell people the story of the Advent days, they're kind of like, well, what are you giving him stick for? He's just the, you know, he's just the guy behind the scenes who's trying to find the buyer. But he was a bit more than that, really, wasn't he? He seemed very keen on the Risto and Heaney deal to go through at the expense of the James Brent deal. Would that be fair to say?
I think that's very fair to say. And I think, you know, if we're writing a villain list, he'd be probably pretty high up there for me. And I mean, you know, a couple of things that, you know, were very distasteful was, I was at a meeting once, I think this has been told by other people I've read and maybe listened to over the years, where he basically said, like, anything's for sale at this club, make me an offer, and got our playoff winning trophy from 96 out of the cabinet and was basically trying to flog it to the people in the boardroom there and then, like, you know, just to get rid of it, basically, you know. So that's to sum up. But I also remember maybe his character, as we started to rattle him, you know, and our online numbers were really good then. We were getting loads and loads of people to admit. We had a big meeting at the pavilions as well. And it was clear that the fans, you know, were just not having this, frankly, crap anymore. We were cutting through it and we were on a march to save the club. I called them out, like, significantly over a prolonged period of time. And there was a couple of things he did which were distasteful. So one day there was a headline in the front page of the Herald about the fans risking the future of the club. So trying to essentially put your average Argyle's fans fire on the likes of me, sort of saying they've gone too far, etc. Which, you know, we had a right reply to and we dealt with. But the other was, I was sent a really nasty legal letter during one occasion, which basically threatened, like, you know, everything I had, which was not a lot and still wouldn't be a lot, but it was, you know, the type of letter I think that was designed to put frighteners and to say, you need to back off here, you know. But what was interesting about that letter is the subject matter they picked to accusing me and the trust at that point of picking out, I knew for a fact was true. So it was one of those moments where you draw a bit of breath when you first read the letter, but then we doubled down and went again and we never heard anything more on that subject matter with Guilfoyle. But yeah, he was an interesting character. When it came to the end as well, and I'm sure we'll get onto that, he made the call to me about saving the club. And I'm sure, you know, we'll talk about it in some detail, but it wasn't a call he was happy to make. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And I think he's never, as for someone who was quite a regular football administrator, he's pretty much never worked in football again. And I do wonder what that spell at Argyle may have done to his reputation in the trade. Obviously, that's me putting two and two together and making five. But who knows? This bid then, this Ridsdale and Heaney bid. Again, my memory of that was that, you know, every day a new layer of it seemed to come about. Like, first of all, there was the Irish consortium, and I think that was because there was a shell company registered in Ireland, and I think that was all it. That was the only link to Ireland. The more and more people peeled it back and did their sleuthing online, it became more and more clear that it was a front for something called someone. And for the avoidance of that, for any lawyers, I don't mean a front in the sense of any illegality, but it was clearly, you know, the real people behind it were being disguised. And I think we all know that. And obviously you set up the working group, which kind of goes in with what you said about bringing the fans together, the trust, the GTs, Pasotti, one or two others as well, I think were involved. And then there was the infamous breakfast meeting, wasn't there, that confirmed the real person behind the Irish bid as being Kevin Healy. And honestly, was that a total coincidence? Did you have no idea he was going to be there at all?
No, it was the stuff of legend, really, when you think about it. It's like comical. You know, if we wrote it down as and said we're going to sell this for someone to make a film, they would go, "No, that chapter's not believable, mate. You need to take that out." So what happened is started to work really strongly with Gary Maguire at the Green Taverners, Ian Newell on Pasotti and other things. But Gary rang me one day, and I remember it. I was in the Britannia pub, and he said to me, like, "Unless we get some money in, the staff can't keep doing this. There's like X amount of people who aren't going to be able to pay their mortgages." And I said, "Well, you know, what are we talking here?" And he said, "Like, we need some money from somewhere, Chris. Can you?" So we started like raising, or sitting there, and we were writing down ideas and stuff. And earlier that week, I'd been given James Brent's number by the council, been given this list of basically the richest people in Devon. And I was like working my way down it, trying to like sort of harass someone into buying Argyle. But anyway, so I was in the Britannia pub, remember it clear as day, rang James, had never obviously met him, and said, like, you know, introduced myself, introduced the plight, and said, like, "I know, you know, you got an interest in the area and a base in the area in Devon. Like, Argyle is a huge asset. You know, if it goes under, then, you know, the damage that does for the city of Plymouth in terms of economically, is it going to impact people like you? Blah, blah, blah. Please don't hang up the phone, etc." He's gone back and said he's not interested in football. He's never seen a game of football. And I said, and then I started, you know, to talk to him about where the staff were at and stuff like that. And he was genuinely really, I mean, James is a great, great man, but he was really taken aback by the staff plight. And he went, "Well, what do you need?" And it's bearing in mind, it's the first time I've ever chatted with him. And I said, £5,000. And he said, I'll transfer you £5,000 for the staff. That was my first call with James Brent. And I said, "Well, I need something else." I said, "Will you agree to meet us?" I said, "Just agree to meet us. That's all I'm asking. Nothing sort of more commitment than that. Just meet us." And he said, "Yeah, I'll meet you. And we'll meet." And he said, "When are you available? Set a date." "Right, let's meet in the Holiday Inn on this date." So I'd arranged a meeting with James on that date. So in one interaction, like with James, he'd given £5,000. And then that night I posted it on Pasotti and said, like, "We've got an anonymous source giving us £5,000. Everyone was really chuffed, etc. Then we went to the breakfast meeting, Ian Newell and myself. I think there was someone else, but I can't remember, hazes you, but Ian Newell was definitely with me. And we said, we were meeting James at, like, say, 10 a.m. And I said to Ian, like, "This guy's going to buy the club. We are effectively going to make him buy the club. We're going to show him the best of Argyle, the fans. We're going to talk about the pride of the city. We are going to go in there and we're going to sell ice to the Eskimos today." And he was like, yeah, let's go. "Well, let's meet at 9 o'clock up in the breakfast room in the Holiday Inn." "Yeah, no problem." So me and Ian go into the breakfast room. We're sat having breakfast and Ian's like sort of facing me and I'm looking at the sort of rest of the breakfast room. And I said, am I allowed to swear on the pod? I'm not allowed to swear. I said, "Fucking hell, it's Kevin Healy." And he was like, "No, it's not. And I'm not joking you." In some sort of like comedy sketch, Kevin Healy had the biggest maps and plans on the table you could ever imagine, with like Home Park, with developments next to it and all that. So I just said, like, "If we don't front him now and out him right now, we'll always regret it." So Ian and I went over, introduced, started taking photos of the plan and everything. And it was like mayhem. He was with someone from the council and all that. Posted, like, "It's Healy. We know it's Healy," etc. Exposed him, went downstairs and met James.
Absolutely incredible. I'm not sure Aaron's shaking his head. Having to bleep out the swearing? Was that the story, Aaron?
No. Just the story. I mean, was there any part of you that, like, felt, sorry if I'm stepping on your toes here, Sam, but was there any part of you that thought that if it was taken out of your hands somewhat and Healy was, you know, involved, that it could have been okay? Or was it just like outright? Yeah. Absolutely no chance. I know he's a bit of words I'm not going to say, but, like, you know, I didn't know if there was any part of you that those plans sort of could have convinced you at all or not.
No, I think for a few reasons. One, because obviously his reputation preceded him and we did the due diligence and that it was clear, like, you know, if it was Healy, then, you know, we would be in serious trouble and it would be a property transaction and nothing more. Yeah. Second, look, you were looking at what he was doing down in Truro, which we was asset stripping that football club. But alongside those things was, you know, was the lion, like, you know, oh, it's an Irish consortium. Oh, it, you know, it's a business person that doesn't want to reveal themselves. If you really had proper, true ambitions for a football club and any business, you should be confident enough to step forward, put your case on the table and go and engage fans, representatives and the fans and the staff and everyone. The fact that he was so shadowy, I think probably told you everything you needed to know. And I think, you know, you guys will experience it in all aspects of your life. You just know when you're looking at someone. I was looking at someone that was like, I have been caught out here, like, you know?
Yeah.
But it was going to be this contrived plan, wasn't it? Whereby, because Heaney couldn't legally own the club because he would still be owner of Truro. And if I remember, it was going to be this ridiculously contrived plan whereby he was the owner of the ground, but Peter Ridsdale was the owner of the club. Mm-hmm. And Peter Ridsdale's a man who a lot of people have very complicated views on. Graham was, had quite a nuanced view on Peter Ridsdale. And I do understand why, because ultimately he did come in and do a job that had to be done to an extent. But how much do you hold anger and resentment towards him? Because at the end of the day, if he hadn't have kept going with this Heaney charade for as long as he did, the James Brent deal could have been a lot quicker, the staff could have been paid a lot better, and Argyle could have been back on their feet a lot quicker. I think we know you quite rightly feel a lot of resentment towards Heaney and towards Guilfoyle, but how much resentment do you hold towards Peter Ridsdale for mothballing that situation, essentially?
I think Peter is probably fitting well with like a modern day politician. If you don't like my politics, I've got others, sort of thing. And he was looking after himself in that transaction, I think. And I don't mean financially, I just mean like in terms of, you know, what was best for sort of his reputation and stuff like that. One thing I would say, you know, about Peter was he was an incredibly charming individual. So, for instance, when I first met him, I was sort of putting a lot of pressure on him, saying, like, things are going to be different now. These aren't warm and cozy chats. They're chats where I'll be reporting back to the fans about exactly where we are. You'll be held to account, etc. And he was going back and forth about being misjudged, you know, as an individual and stuff. And I said, and he, you know, I challenged him on what had happened at Cardiff and what had happened at Leeds United, etc. And that wasn't his fault, and this wasn't his fault. And I said to him, well, let me say to you one thing that tells me you're a terrible judge. And he said, what's that? I said, you sold Eric Cantona to Manchester United for £1 million when you were chairman of Leeds. And he went, I was on holiday. So that should tell you all you needed, but know about Peter's character and reluctance to let things stick to him. But, you know, come the end, once I think Peter realised that incredible force of the fans, the staff, the council and James Brent had so much momentum, he jumped on the winning horse and he went with it and was helpful in getting that deal over the line.
Yeah, and of course he did stay for the first couple of months, didn't he, as chairman under James Brent as well. So it's got to that point then whereby obviously James Brent had a bit of interest in being the preferred bidder, but ultimately he didn't get the preferred bidder status because I think the Heaney consortium, which, and let's be honest, there were probably some people behind Heaney as well, weren't there? We won't try and speculate too much as to who, to avoid the letters arriving at our doorstep. But there may have been some people who, shall we say, were involved with the club in the previous regime who were possibly somewhat linked to the Heaney deal. So he somehow managed to front up 300k, didn't he, to fund the preferred bidder status, and that was why he became the preferred bidder. And obviously, at that time, James Brent maybe needed a little bit more convincing. Like you said, he had to have that conversation with you. At that time, he wasn't quite ready to make that commitment. But as a result of that, then we had this 3 month sort of interregnum between maybe more like 3.5 months between the Heaney consortium being named as the preferred bidder and Ridsdale Guilfoyle finally realising it wasn't going to happen, didn't we? Over that interregnum, there was all this, you know, smoke and mirrors. The money's coming, the money's not coming, the money might be coming. How hard was actually to keep that pressure on? Obviously, bear in mind, the season's getting nearer and nearer. We had no kind of squad. How hard was that just to keep that pressure going on in the face of being, you know, palmed off, fobbed off, if you like, by the hierarchy?
Well, I think it wasn't that hard because by that time, we'd organised the fan base and we'd united the fan base and every sort of facet of it. And, you know, we used like Pasotti really effectively to communicate with people. We used match days, you know, pre-season, etc., to communicate with people. We were really open every time we spoke to them. We gave an update to everyone. We were really open in opposition Tahini and what was essentially the property deal. And we were on a path really to, you know, destroy that bid because it needed to be destroyed or it was going to destroy the football club. So that 3.5 months, I mean, some ways, you know, particularly for like the staff and the players who weren't getting paid, must have felt like years. But for us as fans, Sam, people like yourself, myself, others involved in like the contingency group and stuff, it was probably going a lot quicker. And the contingency group was a key point in that because essentially we just, as a group of people, sort of led by myself probably, brought everyone together, brought the trust together, brought the Taverners together, brought Pasotti together and like stakeholders, like there was the council representative on there. It was Peter Jones who came in at that point, former director, bless him. And then, you know, we started to set out our vision. James Brent obviously came onto that. We set out our alternative vision. And I think the fans were then, long before James got preferred bidder, the fans wanted him. You know, he'd been to meetings with us. We'd taken him to the match, if you remember, the Fans Reunited match. And we had, they were losing momentum and we were gaining it in that 3.5 month period.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you feel in stuff like the Guildhall meeting and that kind of thing, your union experience? Because you mentioned it yourself, you are a union rep, aren't you, in your day job. How do you feel that experience of sort of fighting for people, fighting against the bosses, if you like, helped you in a way that was that really made a tangible difference in that time?
I think it was significant in loads of ways, you know, being able to run a meeting, like, you know, we get there and, you know, at the previous meeting, people are, you know, the club's dying and people are asking if the buses are going to be run next week.
That moment will go down in history, won't it? That was just one of the most iconic. I can remember it to this day, and I think you had to tell everyone to calm down, didn't you? Because everyone was moaning and groaning about that comment. Sorry, right. Carry on.
No, it's fine. It's a good indication that your reaction is an indication of the moment, isn't it? And so we were able, was able to control a meeting. I think of a big crowd, and I think it was able to chair effectively the steering committee through that period with some brilliant people like, you know, John Petrie, Lee Jameson, you know, obviously I've mentioned Peter Ryan and many others and those people who I can't mention. And so that was brilliant. And I think the experience was really knowing that we had to get in their face, you know, stuff like, you know, rallies, online protests, you know, all basic organizing tactics, all deployed sort of day to day working as a rep, were deployed with the fans. And one of the things is about Plymouthians, obviously being a very, very proud one, is we can be a bit relaxed sometimes about some of the things that are going on. So I think it was like at that point, a necessary invention to mobilize the fan space and mobilize we did. I mean, there's some like, so, and it was like, it was brilliant when you think back at it, because obviously I was like a, you know, bona fide trade union rep and it was like second nature, but stood alongside people who I know had like voted Tory all their life or had refused to join a union or had never thought of taking part in a protest. We're all out there like on the streets or outside the ground or online, like fighting for the club.
Yeah, and it was incredible. Excuse me. I remember the time it was exactly as you described. So obviously after you'd been upstairs and you know, finished with Kevin Heaney downstairs and you spoke with James Brent, how long after that did he fully commit to being the guy? Was it that very day or did it take a little bit more time?
Well, that day Ian and I took a presentation and sold Plymouth to him and sold Argo to him. And I think, you know, both of us together, we did it. You know, we can be proud of what we did and we really sold it to him. And we got him that day to say, if there's no one else, I'll do it. So I knew then there was going to be no one else. So I knew then right then that it had to be James. So we were then, I don't know if you remember, we were organising the Fans Reunited match where the Brighton fans were coming down and everything. It was brilliant, wasn't it? And so that was a day. And I rang James and said, why don't you come to the match? Like, you know, we'll keep it low key. You won't tell anyone. You just come along and, you know, we'll sort of, you know, you experience like what I know Argo can be, you know, what I know Plymouth can be and what we know. And he was like, after some battering, was like, yeah, okay. Where should we take? And I said, I'll get us tickets. We'll go in the Devonport end. And so before the match, I went into the Fans Fest, which was, you know, a huge and iconic part of administration and remains an iconic part of the club now to this day, and they're different guys and more professional guys now, went into the marquee, took the microphone and said to everyone, guys, James Brent's coming to the match. Like, you know, he's asked me not to say anything, but I'm going to, like, he's coming to the match and we need his, like, name to be sung. We need this, you know, we need him to be cheered and stuff, you know. Anyway, we get there into the Denport end, and bearing in mind, I've promised him that I'm telling nobody, like, game kicks off. We're there 5 minutes. The Denport end starts singing, James Brent, give us a wave. James Brent, give us a wave. And he looks at me and he goes, what do I do? I went, you just wave. And he wave. And then if you remember, we won the game 2-0 and Denport end was singing, James Brent, what's the score? James Brent, what's the score? He said, what do I do? I went, give him two fingers. And he gave him the 2-0 and got a massive cheer. And I think, like, undoubtedly, seeing his face, and he had his young son, Tom, who's now not so young, strapping young man with him, I knew walking out that that club was going to be bought by James Brent, because he'd, like all of us, he'd caught the Argyle bug in that moment.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Yeah, absolutely. I think by that time, I remember when that date was, because it was the day I, funny enough, moved from Plymouth to Southampton to go to university. So I couldn't make that day. I'd been involved in so much of the events leading up to it, but not the day itself. I have heard many of the stories that it was a fantastic day. And I suppose it wouldn't really be a history of the administration here without touching slightly on the Argyle visual. Now, obviously, with that, again, for those who aren't aware, that was an event where for, I think, five nights even, there was a five-day presence, day and night outside Home Park. Again, all of the groups Chris mentioned, the Pistotti, the Trust, the Taverners, all sort of banding in together. Setting up a camp outside the Devonport end, going into the home game against Crewe, I think it was the following Saturday, and Peter Isdell, in true Peter Isdell style, turns up with a big bottle of champagne, saying the money's guaranteed from Kevin Healy, the club's been saved. And of course, all what eventually unfolded, the only guarantee was that it had apparently been moved from one account to another account, or he'd secured more investors, but still in no way was it a tangible guarantee. And I think that was purely done with the promise of good publicity, wasn't it? And giving the fans something to smile about at the end of that visual. So when he came and said that, you know, the deal was done, I'm guessing you knew very well that it wasn't done.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many factors amongst the campaign to save the club. I think of marches to the ground, the meetings at the pavilions, the Guildhall, the online campaign, the contingency group, the Taverners, Pisotti Trust, you know, the vigil. There were so many things which I think, you know, it all came together, to get us the right result. I wasn't heavily involved in the vigil because this is just me speaking, by the way, not to knock anyone, because I was at that time thinking this fan base needs to be wound up. Like, it doesn't need to be calm. We don't need to be sort of like almost like praying for our future, and we need to get out there and deliver it. So I was sort of whilst the vigil went on, it was brilliant. I was more one eye on like, how do we keep mobilizing the fan base? Because I think anything from those people at that time was fantasy. I with Ian Newell and others had seen the plans on the table, knew it was frankly a load of crap, knew it wasn't going to happen, and knew I wasn't sort of like wanting that money, because that money was never going to come. And every day it did that sort of, you know, jackanory played out, it was risking, you know, people were starving. Fans couldn't, the staff couldn't pay their mortgage, couldn't put food on the table. You know, you think of footballers as like, you know, oh, you know, Carl Fletcher used to have a Premier League contract, all right? They probably had some savings, but we had a half a dozen or more young lads who probably were in the same position as the staff. So I wasn't like thinking, oh, you know, let's wait to see if this money comes through for them. I was thinking, how do we get these people out of the way? So, yeah, it was an interesting point for me, the vigil. And I thought what was strong about it, I think, was it just showed how one another example of how many people cared so much about Argyle that they were prepared basically to be there in freezing cold overnight, you know, showing that you know, won't come one way or the other, then they're not going to let the club die.
Absolutely. So we're now moving into the end game then. I think, you know, shortly after the fans reunited, they, what was implicitly known became official, which was that the Ridsdale Healy debacle was dead in the water. And then from then, James Brent had about 5 weeks, didn't he, to get the deal done. And probably that 5 weeks was just as eventful as the 4 months preceding it, really, weren't they? Quite a lot happened as James Brent was trying to get the deal done. We had the business of running around after players to get them to sign waivers, didn't we? We had, I think, Stapledon got back involved in some way. Why don't you tell us that 5 weeks and your story of it, of that end game?
Just a roller coaster of emotions, really. Literally from posting to, like, you know, and thinking this club's going to be saved to thinking we're gone hour by hour, almost. You know, sometimes less than that, sometimes minute by minute. Sometimes, you know, I think one thing we have to say is, James did an incredible job and never, ever lost his nerve in that moment. I think that, you know, the moment we all packed out the council chambers and got the council in principle to agree to buy the ground was a huge moment, because that essentially made it doable for James to connect the dots and do the other bit. So that was a big moment when the council, you know, agreed to buy the ground. But in that period, it was just up and down. It was constant obstacles, constantly asking for more money from people. And I remember a particular really, really difficult night was when we went away to Oxford on a Tuesday night. And I think we got thumped 5-1, like absolutely thumped. And then, like, I come out of the ground, and obviously, if you're not depressed enough, you've just lost 5-1 at Oxford. You know, you're going that here, you know, if you tumble and the demise of Argyle on the pitch alongside off it continues at pace. James rang me and I was walking back to the coach, and I was on the coach back with the Green Taverners with Gary Maguire and others. And he rang me and said, and I can't remember the specific sum, but I will say to you, it was hundreds of thousands of pounds. And he said, like, the Guilfoyle and co were asking for hundreds of thousands of pounds. He said, I just haven't got it, Chris. He said, I want to be honest with you. He said, and if I can't do the deal at what they agreed to do the deal, and it was to do with fees, for P&A's fees, for basically running the administration, if you remember. And he said, if they won't come down and do this deal, then, you know, I can't buy the club. I can't put my family, and he was being really honest and said, I can't put my family's finances and their future at risk. He said, like, you know, I know I've bought into the club. I can see how much you all love it, but I can't, you know, put my family through that moment. I just haven't got that money. And I remember getting back on the coach and everyone going, oh, James, all right? And I remember going, yeah, he's fine. Because I thought, if I double down with, and this news gets around the internet and the fan base, then that, like, you're going to be, everyone's depressed. So I sort of just held it within myself, if you like, for that 24-hour period. But when I got up in the morning, thought, right, this is it. And I don't know if you remember, Sam, I sort of bit a big long post online and said, we're not going to the game this weekend. We're going to picket Brendan Guilfoyle's offices up in Yorkshire. We're going to take coaches to his offices, and we're going to pick it outside. And also, here's an email address. We want thousands and thousands of emails into them, you know, demanding that they, you know, waive their fees and do the deal with James. So I remember getting loads and loads of abusive content from them saying that you've broken our email server. You know, we got so many emails, and people, like, you know, that's when Guilfoyle came out then and said that myself and others, Ian and others, were threatening the future of the club. So that was a moment I remember, like, I won't name them, but I remember some, like, respected figures in the Argyle fan base on that evening coming on to Presotti and saying, like, I think you might have gone too far here, Chris. You know, I think you might put the club at risk, you guys, of what you're doing. And there was a moment there where there was, if you like, hold your nerve, or do you start saying, "Oh, sorry, Brendan"? Like you know, can we? And sort of, we didn't blink, and we kept going. We kept our foot on the pedal, and we were like, "No, we're not having this. Like, we're going to their offices. We are picketing their offices." And that preludes me into the phone call where the next day, which I can tell you about if you want, which is when basically we didn't blink, they did, and the deal was done.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that will be an incredibly emotional day. Just a couple of other quick points then about just the events leading up to it. I know we've kind of gone a little bit wonky with the chronological order, because I know that the PNA was pretty much the last fight, but there were so many other ones. There was an effort to mobilise again, because I think some of the former directors tried to buy the debt from Lombard. That happened as well, didn't it? That caused quite a lot of stir. And I think, again, that all pretty much ended after a day or two, didn't it? Because I think the idea was that Lombard were willing to either waive the debt or have it over a certain period of time, whereas the certain former directors wanted to actually buy the debt and use that to recoup some of their losses from Argyle, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And by that point, Sam, like, you know, the combination of everything, you know, all the alliances, everyone pulling in the same direction, I think we had a really well-oiled, like, machine by that point. So, like, there was so much momentum with us that whether it was the former directors, whether it was Guilfoyle, whether it was Heaney, we were rolling over the top of them to get to the finish line to save our club, you know, and all the things that, you know, whether it was, like, able to get a load of people online really quickly to do an action, an email or a petition or a lobby, or whether it was we could get hundreds of people, thousands of people to a meeting to discuss the future of the club, whether it was to get people outside the ground doing stuff, whether it was to raise money. We had a really slick and powerful machine. And I think that, you know, from a fans organisational perspective, we can be really, really proud of that. I mean, you know, we did a meeting at the Pavilion, Sam, where there was 2,000 people there. I mean, that's, you know, incredible, like, fans meeting on a proper stage, not like, you know, as much as I love a union meeting in a beer garden or a pub or whatever, like 2,000 people at Plymouth Millions on a match day with, you know, Romain, Lario and Carl Fletcher coming down to show fans solidarity before they went and played the game. Those are moments that I'm sure will live, like, in all the memory of all the Argyle fans that were there and who played in part of it. So I think, you know, all those twists and turns, there became a point where we had the momentum and it wasn't going to stop until the club was saved.
Yeah, even to the point of, I think, having to track down all these numerous ex-players to agree to the deal, one of whom was even in prison, I think. That must have taken quite a lot of effort as well. So go on then, let's hear it. So that Friday, and I remember it was a Friday because we were due to play, we did play Cheltenham, obviously, on Saturday. Talk us through the, and I think it was then absolutely formally confirmed on the Monday, wasn't it? So that Friday to knowing it was definitely going to happen, the jubilation on the Saturday and then the formalisation on the Monday. Just talk us through, starting from receiving that phone call through to the Monday. What sort of weekend was that for you all?
Yeah, hazy one. Yeah, when we went, it was, obviously, as if we touched on a couple of times, at the time, I worked as a union rep on the front line. Now I work at the union's headquarters, doing a different role. But at the time, I was like a rep in Plymouth in the Southwest, and I was representing someone on that morning. So I was in, but I obviously the situation, as we've touched on with Aaron and yourself earlier on, was so fluid and so dynamic and ever changing that, like, my eye was on that phone 24/7. And bearing in mind, the day before was the exchange of you're going to kill the club and us going, we're coming to your headquarters to pick it. We don't care what you say. So it was very sort of high emotion time. I left my, I mean, very unusually for me, I would never done it since or before, left my phone on in the meeting, knowing that, like, I needed to take it sort of thing. So I remember representing someone who was in a bit of bother at Royal Mail, one of my mates actually. So it was all right. I got away with it. And we were going through this case where he was, you know, getting conducted over something he'd done or whatever, and I was representing him as a rep trying to get him out of trouble. And the phone started ringing, and it was Brendan Guilfoyle. And I said, oh, you know, I think we need a recess in the union meeting. So walked out of the meeting, took the call in the sorting office, Royal Mail sorting office in Plymouth, and I said hello. And he was like, you got what you want. Everything's happening. James Brent now owns this football club. The golden share will be returned for the club, and I never want to speak to you again. That was my phone call from To which I was like, right, okay, wow, amazing. So I rang, I like needed to get back in because this guy's job was on the line, bearing in mind he's a background character and I've actually got a day job. Rang James, he was like, yeah, I've just had the email, literally as you rang me. Rang Ian Newell, I think. I posted on Passotti, like it's probably still there. It's like about 10 words because I needed to, and people were thinking, oh, I wanted to get on the beer or whatever. I needed to get back in and represent this guy. So I'm like, you know, job done, club is saved sort of thing, everything. And then I went back in and represented this guy. Luckily, I saw him at Argo against Leeds last week. So he still got his job and he's still working there.
That was going to be my next question. So did he keep his job? So I'm glad you've answered that one for me.
Yeah.
So then Cheltenham again, it's I wasn't there myself after being pretty, certainly not a main character to the extent of yourself or Graham, but being, shall we say, a bit of a background character for the first 7 or 8 months, I had to pretty much duck out because I was starting my university phase of life in Southampton. So that sort of final 5 weeks, so I was pretty much out of all of it, and I was all set to jump on a train to Cheltenham from Southampton and meet everyone there for a few drinks, but my parents announced that they surprised me with booking a visit to Southampton that weekend, so I couldn't. But I went to watch Southampton play at St Mary's instead, and I remember they won 4-0. But for you, who obviously was at that day at Cheltenham, just talk us through the jubilation of that day. I know James Brent received a hero's welcome, didn't he, that day?
Great Western had helped us as well, didn't they, and put on a train. So it was a strange one. And so I was determined, like, you know, I wanted to do the usual thing and go in the way end. And obviously James was then, you know, pseudo owner elect, if you like, at the club. So obviously he was invited in the boardroom and I was having none of it. And I was saying, James, you got to come in the away end, mate. You deserve what's coming your way today. Please come in the away end. You know, and we went in a pub, I think it's called The Spectre in Cheltenham. And honestly, when he walked in, the whole pub erupted. And like, there's only one James Brent, but it was just erupted with like emotion as well. And then when we went into the away end, I think we lost the game either 1-0, 2-0, or something like that. It was standard fare around then, wasn't it? James just got such a hero's welcome from the crowd. It was like, it was unbelievable. And it was so, so well deserved, like, you know. But it was a weird one because I think, like I said to you, when you live in a moment, like I'm sure you guys have had and have in your day-to-day lives and working lives and everything, what was weird about Cheltenham was like the spectacle was amazing. The pre-match atmosphere was amazing. You know, the whole match, people just obviously buzzing to have their club. And then we go and lose the game and you're like, shit, we may go out to Football League here. And it's a new challenge all of a sudden facing you, you know, and when you're just like, we just need to save the club. That's the only focus, isn't it? And then it switched really quickly to like, how do we stay in the Football League, you know?
Yeah, and then of course what came in the days after, obviously James Brent bestowed a very privileged position on, didn't he? Talk us through what happened then with yourself.
So James James asked me if I was interested in going on the board at Argyle. Which my answer was emphatically no, because you know, I just felt like, you know, I'm all for fan owned clubs, and really, you know, as much as I don't like them as a rival, like the model at Exeter City and other clubs and you know, particularly the German model, really, really impressed by, and think we'd like to see in England a lot more. But it wasn't my thing, like, and under the terms and the constructions of a standard ball wasn't my thing. And then he said he went away, and then I met him for lunch or whatever, and he asked me if I wanted to be the president. And, you know, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, you know, short of like putting a ball in the back of the net as a number nine in the back at the Devonport end or being a manager, I'm not sure like could have ever imagined myself being president of the club I've loved my whole life, you know? So it's a huge, huge honour. At the same time, it's a weird one for me because, you know, I look back and 50% of me is like, do you know what? You're the president of the club you loved your life. Like, you know, what a thing. The other thing was like, part of me is like, I'm not sure I was ever suited to something like that. I think I was always suited to like the row, if you like, or the conflict resolution and the cutting edge,
I was going to say, like, how does it differ from, you know, I don't want to generalize unions, but going from like the little man shooting up to being president must have been, like you said, just really weird.
Yeah, it was strange. And like I said, there's moments where I think, well, put it this way. If it was to all happen again and you have this thing of hindsight, I'm not sure I would have accepted the presidency, you know, for loads of reasons. But I think I probably wouldn't. And the main one really was, like, once I stepped down and was back in the match with my mates and stuff like that, you're like, oh, why have I been missing this? Like, you know, it's not really me as an individual. But at the same time, like, the previous president was, like, you know, the Japanese international guy, wasn't he? And, like, there was a little bit of me which is like, well, maybe this is part of, you know, rebirthing the club. Is like, there's a Janna who's a fan. Maybe it was a good sort of balance out for that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you'd struggle to do a lot worse, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it was an interesting time. And then obviously it was testing, because there was a point where James brought Tony Raffle back onto the board. And I got loads of time for Tony. He's a really nice man, and Jackie and his family are lovely, lovely people. But I remember publicly disagreeing with that. And it caused a huge hassle for James within his own board at the time, and a bit of a split with people saying, like, get rid of him as president, like, he's been disloyal and all that sort of stuff, you know, and James didn't. But I think probably it would have been much healthier for me to be not president and to be outrightly criticising. And that was nothing to do with Tony. I mean, what I've, you know, latterly come to realise is, like, Tony's a fine, fine individual, as are his family, and perhaps he was hoodwinked by some of the previous administration and the board, you know, and he was one of the good guys. But I just felt at the time, like, you know, that the fans were so scarred from that previous regime that even allowing for that, it wasn't the right thing to do. So I spoke out, and it caused James loads and loads of hassle, and probably caused me, like, conflict. Whereas if I was speaking freely, it would have just been, well, this is my view, you know, I'm like take it or leave it, you know? Mm.
Yeah, you've sort of answered I know how Aaron feels now, because you sort of answered what was going to be my next question, because I know that obviously at that time there was a lot of, you know, disagreement back and forth amongst fans about some issues. Some of it was, as you say, very small P politics. Some of it was quite, you know, small time, wasn't it? But obviously there was some of it that was very substantial as well. And there's some of it that was about issues that were of great impact, like the Higher Home Park redevelopment that ultimately never happened. And like, obviously, as you mentioned, like I was going to say, bringing Tony back on board, and maybe to an extent, you and I disagreed on those issues, Chris, obviously more than we did on the administration. Not that we disagreed on Raffle, I pretty much entirely agree with you on that, but on the Higher Home Park, I felt that there was a bit of an issue around separating the ownership of the club from the car park land. I felt that would maybe hem us in a bit and sort of, shall we say, have a net detrimental impact on our ability to maximise revenue in years to come, which obviously has now been rectified under Simon Hallett. The club now has that land back. But thinking back at that, was there a bit of it that you thought to yourself, you know, I don't want to use the phrase poacher turned gamekeeper, because I don't doubt that you were saying what you want to see believed, but was there a bit of you that was almost sort of doubting, like you say, from being someone who was on the outside questioning, querying, having a bit of a ruck, was there a bit of you that sort of resented or struggled with having to defend the club position on stuff like that at times?
No, because I wasn't defending the club position by that point. And I think, like, you know, what had become clear at that point is it in effect, in a degree of honesty, like, you know, James's loyalty to me for what happened in the administration period and the friendship and the alliance that we built up will hold strong, hopefully, forever. Like, he's a great friend of mine. And what I'd sort of done by that point is started to sort of take a step backwards and backwards and backwards. And it had become really an unsaid thing between James and I, which was, like, you know, when someone comes along, like Simon came along, which is, like, absolutely brilliant, like, we'll both head off into the sunset. So my role sort of become, well, you don't want to use the word tokenistic, but I suppose it's probably a decent description of it, you know, more like, yeah, he's the president, but, like, you know, just that's it, really. It fades into the background, you know. And I mean, you know, like, we'd have a, if something was wrong, we'd always be on the phone, or I felt it was wrong, or I felt the majority of the fan base felt it was wrong, would challenge James, you know, or whoever, regularly, sort of in private or in the right way, or occasionally publicly. But I think that the difficulty, you know, what I saw watching it all play out was the club had no money, literally no money. And, you know, we all go, you know, what we should do is this. What I mean, right now, for example, yeah, let me give you a good example. Right now, I think the club's under ambitious on capacity of the stadium. That's what I think as a Plymouth Argyle supporter, yeah? Now, I know there's vast majority of fans who are like, oh, we need to stay in the Championship for 4 or 5 seasons, keep selling out the ground and that. But, like, I grew up as a football fan, and in my head, you're not a proper club unless you've got a 20, 25,000-seater stadium. And I know we could be filling that this season, yeah? So I'm saying that now to Simon. So that's a challenge to him. And he's saying, well, you know, economically, that don't, I'm not saying I'm saying that because I haven't, but I'm giving a view. And he would say to me, as he would say in the fans forums, that's not economically viable. That's not a priority at this juncture, you know? So I think like the right of fans to criticize is enshrined in football. Like last week, for example, yeah. Like the team win at Middlesbrough, which was brilliant. Like every single person with green blood in them is buzzing with that result. But that doesn't mean we weren't entitled the week before to say that isn't good enough, because that's what people pay their money for. They're entitled to, if long as they do it in the right way and they're respectful and they're decent, they're entitled to challenge the board. They're entitled to challenge the management, because these people, whether they're owners, whether they're as good as they are, whether they're managers as good as they are, players, they're passing through. Like, we're the custodians of the club, if you like. They're the custodians, sorry. But the heartbeat of the club is its fans.
There's also an element to that, right? Like, even if it is going well, even if it is, you know, running at 92% or whatever, you still have to ask those questions, because it's when you stop asking those questions that, I don't want to say people get too much, they don't get too much leeway, but do you know what I mean? That they start believing in their own ideas and stuff, and you know, that can also be detrimental, right? Like, too many seasons,
I'd say. Exactly. And I'm sure that's, like, say someone like Simon or someone like James, they would come to expect it. You know, they haven't become really successful business people by everyone agreeing with everything they've ever said. They've been challenged. They, you know, they've had their ideas, their costings, everything, you know, their values. They've had them scrutinized. They've had due diligence done. So, you know, they would expect, like, people to do that in a different arena, in a football arena. Like, you know, I'm sure it's absolutely fine at Argyle right now, but for me, as a Championship club, we haven't got a decent enough backroom staff. We don't, like, seem to have the infrastructure, like sort of coaching, etc., of a Championship club. Now, that might be absolute crap, because we just went away and we outfoxed Middlesbrough, who probably got one of the most vast coaching teams in the Championship, you know? So it might be absolute rubbish what I'm saying, but, like, we're entitled to say it and have a chat about it. That's what makes football so brilliant, isn't it?
Mm. Absolutely. So if you don't mind me asking, then, without wanting to obviously give away too much of what would have been a private conversation, I'm guessing you were sort of getting the same answers from James when the plans for the home park capacity were revealed, because that sort of penned us in at about what would have been about 17,500 then. So were you sort of having similar conversations behind the scenes to the ones you're having now?
Yeah, 100%. And you know, and he was working absolutely everything possible to drain every sort of seat we could out of that amount of pound, if that makes sense, you know. So that's not a, but we have ended up, if you like, we've ended up around that anyway, haven't we? Well, we've ended up less than that.
Well, that is true, yeah. We are actually slightly less, if anything, yeah.
So I mean, you know, like, if we thought I don't know, 17,500 was unambitious, we're now selling out and capping at 16,500, aren't we? Maybe Sam, maybe you were wrong, mate. Maybe if you listened to James, you could have had 1,000 extra seats there.
well, who know? Well, 700, I would say, in a first, because there still would have been segregation. But that 700 people who might have seen us beat Norwich 6-2 that didn't. So who knows? Maybe you're right.
You've cost those 700 people all those moments of glory. I'm pinning that just on you, Sam.
I shall wear my sackcloth and ashes to the next game in penance. In all seriousness, I want to ask one more question about the post-administration era before we end on a bit of a happy note, because I know Aaron's got a few questions about what we can do to help Torquay and you know, what you absolutely did very well, and I think even your Sterling questions would agree you did very well, what was bring everyone together in that administration era of your Pasotti, Taverners, trust individuals, etc. James Trent tried to do something very similar in the what was initially the GAS board, which then, because everybody took Mickey out of the name, became the PASB, where he would get representatives from all of the above organisations and a few others, I think, to sit and have a board meeting where he would give feedback to the club, sorry, give feedback to the fans, receive feedback from the fans, and there would be that fan consultation, you know, ongoing. Why do you think the PASB didn't really work, in your view?
Janet.
Because I don't think we can argue it didn't work. Yeah, go on. Janet.
Yeah. The sort of, I think, and this is what I was saying earlier on about, like, you know, sort of injecting that sort of militancy into the fan base. When the club was saved, I think everyone, loads of people were exhausted. I think that's the first thing. You know, from that period, people were just exhausted and like, well, that's my lot to give. Other people were just like buzzing, get me back to the ground, see you later, fans trust, see you later, you know, sort of politics of the club. And then I think, like, if I'm being honest, like, you know, so that sort of like heightened situation and heightened pressure that had attracted people like me, Peter Ryan, like Ian Newell, and people who could see their way through a row was no longer there, and it was peacetime. So if you see, like, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, I think you know me, I'm not a fan of like war, and particularly sort of not at times like now, but you know, that sort of peacetime leadership, wartime leadership, that sort of balance, if you like, we moved to sort of a more peacetime settlement, and that required different types of people, which it came to the fore. But then, like, when you go in, right, let's have a meeting because this club may die tomorrow. You get 2,000 passionate Argyle fans turn up. When you say let's have a meeting because we need to know whether the number 67 from Plimstock to Home Park is going to run on a match day or not, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get your, I don't know how to even term this, you're going to get your more interested supporters who are going to go there. What would they say on Twitter now? You're going to say you get
people like me, basically. Yeah, people like me would go, but nobody else. That's what would happen.
Yeah, they would call them, what are they calling them, the dry robe supporter? They would go
the dry robe. Yeah, that's right. That seems to be a bit of a online meme at the moment, doesn't it? But yeah, I completely take on board the point of what you're saying, Chris. And it's been an absolute pleasure to relive some of that era. The only slightly sad thing for me is actually looking back at now and then listening to some of the names you mentioned, how many are actually sadly no longer with us. And I guess that sort of says how much time has passed since then, doesn't it? That's probably it for me, Chris. It's been, again, been a pleasure talking to you and reliving old times.
And you, Sam. Really enjoyed it, buddy.
We can't do a My Argyle Life with you without obviously mentioning that that rousing speech at Wembley. Most probably the highlight of everyone's day, to be honest, because that whistle went and it just turned to mulch and was one of the worst days of my life, genuinely. So there's no real question here. Just like what sense of like pride did you have? Because obviously that's a massive thing, right? Being given that opportunity to,
yeah,
you know. What was there, like 38,000 Janners there?
Yeah, it was incredible, wasn't it? I mean, it's a day I can look back with more fondness now than on the day.
Yeah.
So it was also a day, right, where crossroads came for, do I want to be president or do I not want to be president on that day? Because, right, like, all of my mates were in the Green Man, absolutely off their trolley. Yeah. Going wild, like setting off smoke bombs, singing, sending me clips after clips after clips, and like literally having the time of their lives. And they had that pit of the day, which is no matter how it went on the pitch, they always had that together. Yeah. I had to be at the ground at 11 a.m. when Wembley was totally empty for a sound test.
Right.
And I'd got there and I'd done it. And I was, again, something you should look back extremely fondness. Obviously, as president, I was in the Royal Box. So I look back now and I'm like, I've got to take my son in the Royal Box at Wembley, who's now, you know, he's now an Argyle fan who goes every single away game. Absolutely loves it. He was attacker and now he's 21 this year, you know. Goes Argyle home and away like relentlessly. So I got to take him in the Royal Box at Wembley and I got to speak in front of 60,000 people before the match, like wow. The other side of that coin is like I would have wanted to be sat in with the fans having a sing song, which we didn't sing much because it was rubbish, wasn't it? But I would have wanted to be in that pub with my mates having a laugh and having Sam buying me a shot to roll back the years. But I didn't do that. And also the game, obviously, as everyone knows, was abysmal, wasn't it? We just didn't turn up. And then after the game, I was living in Milton Keynes. So even after the game, it was quite sad because all the Argyle fans went to one Wembley station and I walked off with the Wimbledon fans, obviously having the time of their lives and celebrating. So, yeah, it was a really mixed day. But actually, you know, as far as, you know, getting to say a few words in front of the fans at Wembley, I mean, yeah, what a buzz, like, what a privilege as well.
Yeah, and I know it doesn't compare, but I mean, the odd occasion that I've done like hospitality at Argyle, it just doesn't feel right. It just doesn't, like, you're in like a padded seat and yeah, it's a nice bit of chicken or whatever, but you're like, you know, not really the same, as it's not the same routine, it's not seeing the same people and the same faces. Like you said, having a few pints. I mentioned it in the intro, Torquay United find themselves in a similar fight. I suppose you've already touched on fans United. I suppose really, how much did that support from fans of other clubs, namely Brighton? I think Torquay were quite a big one. I can't really remember like individual clubs because there were just so many. I remember the shirts that came flooding into the fan fest that pretty much every club that robbed us of some brilliant player for pennies, like Charlton and Bristol City as well. How much did that help and how much did that aid Argyle's cause?
Oh, massively, because I think, like, if you said, you know, did it change direction or speed of anything, then probably not. But what it did is I mean, Sam will attest to this because he was obviously heavily involved as well, is it was just a constant roller coaster of emotions. And what it did is it just gave people a good lift at when they needed it, you know, to go there and to say, actually, it's not just us, other people care about us and other people care about this football club and football clubs in general. So I think it was like an emotional thing. More than anything, like a mental thing that gave you that lift just at the time you need it. And then it was carried on, obviously, online as well as fans attending the match. And the Torquay situation you've touched on, Aaron, is horrendous and has lots of similarities, doesn't it? And I'm sure that Argyle fans, you know, whether it's another fans reunited, whether it's like online forums like this, whether it's raising money. I mean, I saw so many Argyle scarves and shirts in the crowd at Playmore in the photos from the weekend, which is fantastic. And I think there's a game later in the month when we've got an international break, and I would really encourage Argyle to like pack that out, and I'm sure we will. But I think like there's lots to be learned from what we went through and lots of expertise that we can lend Torquay, and we should.
Yeah, I mean, that was literally going to be my next question is, you know, what advice do you have for, I think it's a, you know, Torquay United Supporters Trust, their fans, you know, you've touched on it, their own mammoth fight. In some ways, you could argue it's a bigger fight, right? Than because, you know, it's a smaller club. And we're not exactly massive, as much as we like to chat about it. We are the forgotten club when people list off the names of clubs that nearly went out of business. Nobody ever says, oh, and Argyle. You know, what can we do? Obviously, you've mentioned that, you know, going up there and support, but like, what can we do and offer them as a collective to aid them in this fight?
I think as a sort of message, it would be to the fans to like, don't undervalue your influence. Because I think there was some of that going on at Argyle, which we got in and we changed. Cause like, you know, it's like a boss, a CEO or whatever, and you're a worker, you're not sure whether you can influence that person or, you know, that person's this big sort of all powerful individual. And it's a bit like that in football. And football has this thing of like, yeah, but it don't work like that in football. Oh yeah, but this is football, so that wouldn't happen here. When in fact, that's just a load of smoke and mirrors, you know? And I would say to the Torquay fans, if you organise, if you get, you know, all the components we had, like get the money together, get the militancy together, get the community together, get the politicians in the local area together, and like, not shirk anything and go at, you know, this situation, then you'll save your football club. And from our perspective, like, I think it's money, it's online support so people can see, they can feel it, it's attending the games, and it's like sending speakers. You know, people like Sam should be going to meetings there and sharing the experience of those moments for that Argyle had. And you're right there, Aaron. We are the forgotten list club on that list of teams that have been in administration. And I think obviously, you know, Bury went, didn't they? And it was so sadly they went. But like other than Bury, I reckon we were the closest of any club to actually going. Like we were like, you know, I had those calls with Guilfoyle where like, you know, where his toys were out of the plan. And he was prepared, I believe, until we pushed him so far where he realised the consequences. He was prepared to let his ego kill our club. And the fans didn't have it. And I know the Torquay fans aren't going to have it either.
Yeah, this might be like an incredibly open question to finish on that we could probably do a whole pod on. So you don't have to make it like a big thing. But do you think that, obviously, football does have an ownership problem, right? But obviously, you know, being both sides of that table, if you like, you know, being on the board or club president and being chair of the Fans Trust and, you know, facing both of those roles, like internally and externally, what do you think that could be done within like boardrooms to stop this ownership issue? Obviously, I mean, like the simple answer is don't sell clubs to wrong'uns, right? But like, do you advocate like a golden share or you know, where there's a fan on the board? Like, I don't know. What are the options?
So, I think that's certainly an option. I think I think due diligence, like it's football's like no other, like, you know, it's obviously a business, isn't it? But it's like no other business in the world, like where like a cowboy can walk in and all of a sudden own your football club. That wouldn't happen in any other industry or sector of the economy. And I think we, you know, football clubs need to be held to exactly the same due diligence and standards of a normal business. I think like more fan ownership. And having that sort of golden share, like the German model, is a big, big thing. And I think it being like literally, you see the attacks on trade unions in this country from this government, not to get political, but it's the same for fans organisations. I think like Fans Trust should be recognised by clubs through like, you know, through legislation where, you know, fans have a right to have a voice on these things. And then I think you need to strip down key issues and, you know, if you campaign on single issues, then you can win like on those issues, and that leads to collective wins. So, you know, replica shirts, even Argyle, like, you know, it ain't right. You're paying like the money you're paying for a kid's kit, you know, let alone go into bloody the Premier League and stuff like that. You know, the price of a match day ticket at some of these clubs, you know, the standard and the pricing of food, etc. And I think, like, you know, really, there should be the development of a proper fans charter, which enables, you know, real change in the game. And that includes the boardroom, but it also includes like off the pitch, because you get loads of fans. Like my mates always used to rib me because, like, obviously, you know, got a political persuasion, a political interest. And they go like, oh, you know.
I don't think you've ever mentioned it, Chris.
No. They would say like, you know, leave politics out of football. But like politics seeps into every single fiber of life. We're literally sat in plastic seats because like a government decided to ban safe standing to target a group of working class people. Like, you know, there's no escape from politics in any aspect of life. So we have to, as a group of supporters, you know, I'm not talking Argyle, I'm talking every club. We have to meet that head on with our own, for me, our own charter for football, which I think is long overdue.
Yeah, I think, like I said, we could do a whole podcast on it. Yeah. And it's its own thing. And maybe in the off season we might. I mean, you know, we've got a list of ideas. We can add it to the bottom. If people want to hear it, then maybe we can do that. It's interesting how we in this country ridicule, maybe not ridicule is a word, but like we look at the Germans and say, like, do you not want more money in your game? But then like, but the only time we've really come together as a complete unit is obviously the Super League. And even then it was only really fans of four or five clubs and whatever, but that the potential is there for movement.
Just quickly, can I remember that on most of these, we've always ended it with a little bit on Argyle and how we're doing at the moment. So what do you think of us this season? What do you think of Ian Foster so far? And what do you think the club needs to do to get to the next level?
So I think, you know, I think the club's doing incredibly well. I mean, you cannot hide away from the fact that we have the lowest budget in the division. So if you're applying like data, like Simon Hallett likes to, the data says we should be bottom of the league. What I've really, really proud of, and sort of talk about the first chunk of the season, was led by Schumacher, was we've came up and had a go. You see so many teams who are promoted through the divisions and get to the Championship or get to the Premier League, and they completely you know, they park the bus, change the style, and just get beaten week after week, and it just, you just fade away into like nothingness. We've come up and we've had a proper go. I think, you know, what happened with Schumacher was really unfortunate, and it, you know, I'm not sure it's going to work out for him, but that was his choice. And the club did incredibly well to recover from that situation, right on the doorstep of a January transfer window, thrown into utter turmoil. It did really, really well. I mean, I think the honesty is with a manager, it's really hard to judge this early in. You know, I mean, like negatively, if you like, there seems to be, we seem to have lost a bit of our gusto and our pizzazz and style at home. I think that is a sure thing. But we've picked up two more away wins than the zero we had all season before Ian came in. And he certainly like solidified us. And I think, you know, if you allow for that transitional period between the two managers, two completely different styles. Like, for example, a tidbit I picked up was that after the games now, Ian keeps the players in for an hour, like England style, and they go through an hour. They run through immediately the whole game, like Southgate does at England. So, you know, Schumacher wasn't doing that. So you're talking like mass change to the amount of data, the amount of sort of information that these players are getting whilst there's one game every 3 days. So, like, you know, it's a massive amount. So I think you'd have to say, like, you know, get 10 more points. Plus, we're likely to be in this division next year. And that was the target at the start of the season. So well done. I think it'll be a really, really interesting summer. I'm looking forward to seeing like the Ian Foster side of August 2024. And I think that's when, as long as we stay up and we give him the summer to imprint his style, bring in his players, you know, maybe we'll sell Morgan potentially and reinvest that money. Like, you know, you've seen what Coventry have done, for example. They've rebuilt their team, haven't they? And they're coming again, I think. Exciting times ahead for Argyle. I mean, my thing would be, like, if you look at Luton or you look at other teams who've done it well, is to get in that top six. And if you can get in that top six, then anything can happen. I think Simon's said it himself, hasn't he, which is really honest, is, like, the budget isn't there. You look at, like, Leeds, 60-odd million quid playing budget. We've got 6 million. We're not going to reach that. We're going to need to sell, reinvest, sell, reinvest until we can consistently be in and around the top 6 to 10. And we're going to need to get there 1 year, and we're going to need a bit of luck. And hopefully, you know, we can all dream of seeing Argyle in the Premier League. What a thing that would be, wouldn't it? We have a message to Simon Allott. You're going to need to put some more seats in then, Simon.
I think if we get to the Premier League, then we'll have to do it somewhere other. Anyway, that really is it for me now. Aaron, anything else you wanted to say?
No, I suppose the last thing is, how proud are you of yours, the GTs, the Fans Trust, the, what's the other one that I'm missing, Bassotti's efforts, or collective fan base's efforts, seeing where the club is now? Obviously, we're talking about Premier League aspirations, right? Like, as you said, at that point, we thought it was done and dusted. Just how proud are you of that transition from best door to Premier League?
When we were knocking about doing it, it was probably Blue Square Premier League was more likely than the actual Premier League, wasn't it? And really proud. And you used the word collective, and it was collectivism that delivered that. And, you know, the sort of inner strength that the staff had to, you know, keep going and keep to work. The players had to keep going to work without being paid, and all those sorts of things, and the fundraising and the internet activity and the in-person activity. Really, really proud. I've probably finished though by saying, I think in the last sort of decade or so, we've seen the three most influential figures at Argyle and Argyle's history. And I think the first one's James Brent, because, you know, let me be very clear for anyone who may be in any doubt, no James Brent, no Argyle, like full stop. And so I think James was really honest about what he had the capacity and resources to achieve. And then I think the second and third most important people were Simon and Jane Hallett, who have taken it on to that next level and done an incredible job as well. And it may be at some point that, just as there was a baton passing from James to Simon and Jane, there may be a pattern to be passed on. Who knows? I'm sure, you know, ever-growing Argyle is an attractive prospect for someone. But no, we're really, really proud of everything. I'm proud of everyone as well who was involved back on, and Sam and everyone included. And I think, you know, we can look back on that era with fondness, but equally, like, you know, I'm really happy to be back in the throes of Argyle is about the 3 p.m. till 5 p.m. on a Saturday and 7:45 to 9:45 on a Tuesday.
Exactly that. I think we're hugely grateful to yourselves. I'll include you there, Sam, as well. Go on, I'll be nice. You know, everybody you've named throughout, you know, as Sam was saying, the people that we've lost along the way as well. Everybody has played a huge part in the fact that we do have that, you know, that Saturday, 3 p.m.
I've got a question for you, Aaron, if that's all right.
Oh, go on then.
As the Argyle Life budget, podcast budget, does it not stretch to buying Sam a laptop stand?
No. Well, I mean, I've offered to buy him a mic, but he's not a fan of that.
You're not having it, yeah?
No, I mean, the budget isn't, despite being...
Yeah, there he is.
despite being part of the TalkSport fan network, there's not a huge amount in the kitty, I won't lie. Hopefully soon. If people keep listening, liking, subscribing, sharing, commenting, maybe we might stretch to buy Sam a personalised laptop stand.
Maybe it'll stretch to pay me enough money that I can move into my own flat and I don't have to worry about house mates. That would be the real aim. But I think we're a little bit off that yet.
If we can afford your rent, we definitely can't afford a chair. So, with that, I think we'll call that a night. I really appreciate you jumping on, Chris. Like I said, I've basically been sat here listening along. Really insightful. And look forward to what the future holds. Cheers.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.